indeed died of simply of malnutrition just today in the past 24 hours. Rada, what details do you have for us there?
Every passing hour carries more loss and more grief for the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and particularly for those in Gaza City itself, which is subjected to the Israeli brutal attacks since the beginning of the ground invasion the Israeli army announced 5 days ago. And since then, the carpet bombing of the city continues. The artillery shelling, the air strikes, the explosive laden reports that are very destructive and very damaging, and which is remarkably horrible how the Israeli occupation army is now using these explosive reports in order to level to the ground blocks, whole residential blocks and whole residential buildings, of the high-rise buildings and the still remaining buildings in the areas of Gaza City, particularly in the axis of the Israeli occupation tanks progression or advancing axis. Since the dawn of this morning, at least 20 people were killed, and the massacre was against Al-Habir family in Ashata refugee camp. 5 of the same family, including 4 children, were actually reported killed as a result of this airstrike that targeted them directly. Another attack also targeted Mahdi family in Ashata refugee camp as well. However, the number of the casualties and the number of the people who were killed as a result of these airstrikes on Ashata refugee camp is not figured for sure, actually, as the civil defense crews are not able to extract those from under the, who are dead or those who are martyred under the rubble of the destroyed buildings. As you know, the civil defense workers are working with their bare hands, without any equipment, with no vehicles, under the dangers and amidst the challenges that are accumulating and increasing every day as the Israeli occupation army is actually advancing more towards the most populated areas and committing more massacres every passing hour. Nowadays, the policy that the Israeli occupation army is using towards the Palestinians remaining in Gaza City is that pressuring them by committing massacres against them, by committing bloodshedding more of the civilians and committing massacres in order to pressure them, in order to push them or to punish them for staying in Gaza City or to push them out of the city.
Ghada, I'm afraid that is the rest. That's the only time we have left. Ghada Ibrahim, as always, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah. As always, stay safe and thank you very much for those updates. Another Israeli soldier has been killed in the Gaza Strip. The regime's military confirms the death of one of its officers during fighting in Gaza City. According to the IOF, the slain officer, identified as a company commander in the Armored Corps, succumbed to his injuries that he sustained on Monday. The IOF says Hamas operatives fired an RPG on one of the 77th Battalion's tanks belonging to the regime. This marks the first confirmed death of an Israeli soldier since Israel launched its ground offensive against Gaza City. According to the IOF, over 900 Israeli soldiers and some 70 officers have been killed since the beginning of the genocidal war on Gaza in October 2023. Many, however, believe Israel undercounts the fatalities among its troops. Well, Canada and over 20 European countries, including France and Germany, have called on Israel to restore the medical corridor between Gaza and the occupied West Bank. In a joint statement, those countries' foreign ministers expressed their readiness to provide financial support, medical personnel, and equipment to assist Palestinians who are in need of health care outside of Gaza. They urged Israel to lift restrictions on the delivery of medicine and medical supplies and to allow the United Nations and humanitarian organizations to carry out essential life-saving operations. Since October 2023, Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza has severely restricted access to medical care. Thousands of patients need medical evacuation for treatment unavailable in the besieged strip. The Gaza-bound Global Sumut Flotilla, carrying humanitarian aid, is now in the international waters south of Greece. The flotilla's aim is to break the Israeli-imposed siege of the war-torn Palestinian territory. Our correspondent Camila Escalante earlier joined us with an update on the flotilla's location and its situation.
The majority of them, like you said, are to the south of Greece. They will be meeting up with the handful of boats that have departed from Greece. And they say that they're in the final weeks of this journey. Of course, normally they would be moving at a much faster pace, but because they have some vessels that don't have quite the capacity, it seems that it will take at least a week to get from to Gaza from where they are right now at this reduced pace. But they are within 4 or 5 days from what they consider to be a high-risk zone just outside of Palestinian waters, where historically boats have been intercepted and the detentions by the IOF have taken place. Israel continues to try to discredit the flotilla, saying that it poses a security risk and using this sort of rhetoric to manufacture consent for the possible use of lethal force against these humanitarian volunteers. Meanwhile, yesterday, the Global Simud Flotilla put out a statement saying that they have seen drones over the boats crossing the Mediterranean in recent days.
Well, Spain has called for the admission of Palestine as a full member of the United Nations after more countries announced their recognition of the Palestinian statehood. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said the process for admitting the state of Palestine to the UN must be completed as soon as possible. He issued the call after 6 European countries, including France, formally recognized the Palestinian statehood at a high-level summit ahead of the annual UN General Assembly. French President Emmanuel Macron addressed the summit on Monday, announcing his country's recognition of Palestine as a state. The announcement drew praise from the Palestinian Authority that described it as historic and courageous, the decision taken by Paris. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also spoke at the summit, saying the statehood for Palestinians is a right, not a reward.
What is the alternative? A one-state scenario where Palestinians are denied basic rights, expelled from their homes and their land, forced to live under perpetual occupation, discrimination, and subjugation? How is this possible in the 21st century? How is it acceptable? This is neither peace nor justice. It will only increase the growing isolation of Israel on the global stage, and let's be clear, statehood for the Palestinians is a right, not a reward.
Guterres called the situation in Gaza intolerable and deteriorating, citing Israel's killing of tens of thousands of civilians, as well as hundreds of UN humanitarian workers. He stressed that nothing can justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people or any form of ethnic cleansing. The UK, Portugal, Australia, and Canada are among Western states which have joined over 150 countries that recognize a Palestinian state. In the UK, hundreds attended a ceremony at the Palestinian mission to mark London's recognition of Palestine as a state.
Outside the Palestinian mission in London, history in the making. The iconic Palestinian flag raised, preceded by an impassioned speech by the country's ambassador, flanked by British politicians.
This moment is not only about Palestine. It is also about Britain and the British government's solemn responsibility. It is about ending the denial of the Palestinian people's inalienable right to freedom and self-determination. And it is an acknowledgement of a historic injustice.
The ceremony follows the UK's recognition of Palestine as a state, aligning Britain with more than 140 countries worldwide.
This is now officially the Palestinian embassy in London, the country's flag atop this pole for the first time since the UK's recognition of the country. It is a symbolic but powerful moment, the participants here say, one that affirms a nation's struggle for self-determination that has gone on for far too long.
But beyond symbolism, questions remain. With the genocide in Gaza ongoing, the West Bank under occupation, and Britain's continued arms sales to Israel, does recognition mean anything?
British government recognizes Palestine, carries with it responsibilities. Responsibility not to supply arms to Israel. Responsibilities not to share military information with Israel. And a demand, which we will be intensively making, for full economic sanctions against Israel, including all trade embargoes, until the occupation ends.
In the run-up to the recognition announcement, a YouGov poll found less than half of Britons saying recognition was a good idea, while only 18% disagreed.
I can understand the skepticism and cynicism with the history of this whole area. So I can understand that completely. My role as a parliamentarian and the people that I represent, and which are the good people of this country, and millions of them, will now ensure that they utilize this position to take it to the next step.
At the same time, there are other voices in Britain, like those at this debate in Birmingham, who say while recognition was long overdue, the only way forward is one state, not two.
The two-state proposition is clearly a Zionist talking point. It's designed to kick the can down the road, to continually kick the can down the road, to never, ever be in a situation where such a notion could ever be brought into existence.
For supporters here, today is about hope, solidarity, and international legitimacy. For Palestinians under bombardment, it's a reminder that recognition alone is not liberation. Saeed Pourrezeb, London.
Well, clashes have broken out between Italian police and pro-Palestinian protesters in Milan during a day of nationwide protests and strikes aimed at denouncing the genocide in Gaza. Riot police used tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. According to Italian media, the protesters were trying to halt traffic at Milan's central station. Thousands of people also demonstrated in other Italian cities, including the capital of Rome. In the southern city of Naples, skirmishes erupted as protesters entered the city's main railway station. Grassroots unions across Italy had called for a 24-hour general strike in solidarity with the people of Gaza. Iran's president has criticized some of the world powers for adopting unilateralism and authoritarianism, as well as using their power as leverage to ruthlessly kill people in other regions. Masoud Pezeshkian made the criticism upon his departure for New York to attend the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Pezeshkian said he will try during his trip to convey Tehran's commitment to peace, security, justice, and humanity. The Iranian president ruled out talks with those who bully, sow destruction, and stir up mischief. He also condemned the Israeli actions in Gaza and denounced the countries that support the Tel Aviv regime while claiming that they support democracy and human rights. Apart from addressing the UNGA, Pezeshkian is expected to meet with world leaders and some Iranian nationals living abroad during his trip to New York. Well, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is ready to help find a diplomatic solution to the activation of the so-called snapback mechanism of the 2015 nuclear deal, provided that its interests are protected. Abbas Araghchi said Iran is ready to accept such a diplomatic solution, but it must secure the interests of the Iranian nation and address the country's security concerns. He stressed that the current situation of the 2015 agreement is the result of Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the deal. Araghchi said if the U.S. had not quit the agreement, Iran was ready to find diplomatic solutions to the existing problems. He emphasized that Iran will resist all pressures, but believes that a diplomatic solution would benefit the entire region and the international non-proliferation regime. Araghchi also met with the Director General of the UN Nuclear Agency, during which he highlighted Tehran's responsible approach to Iran's nuclear issue. He told Rafael Grossi that any progress on this issue would depend on responsible behavior of other parties and not using the UN Security Council to mount pressure on Iran. Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
The dark. questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, said, a righteous child is an aromatic plant from Allah, which he has distributed to his servants. Yes, a very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. You're listening to the lightning waves of IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab, your host, and I have the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Brother Liaqat is our guest speaker today, who has a background in the psychology, and also he is a scholar in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. And this makes him a perfect guest, having a blend of psychology plus Hawza. So, we are ready to learn about Islamic topics from him. Today, usually we discuss the questions or the topics here that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. Our answers are rooted in the guidance of Holy Quran, the Ahadith of Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and also the guidance from the narrations of noble Imams, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon them. So, let's begin with Quran. We have a lot of ahadith regarding learning Quran, how important it is. And Imam Ali al-Islam has put a more emphasis on to contemplate Quran. So because he considers just reciting Quran and not getting into its meaning as something like, for example, if you go and a couple of times you're getting a water in a basket, a dirty basket, but it has its own impact even if the basket does not get filled with water. We'll discuss that, but our main topic with you today is like, how do you guide parents to teach their children to learn more about Quran other than memorization thing? Memorization is also good at the same time, but because some are only into memorization. Mm-hmm. So how would you guide them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So actually it's a beautiful question though. The thing is, just like you have said, memorization is a good thing and it should be done. Other than that, parents should also encourage their children to recite the Holy Quran with understanding.
Yeah.
So for understanding to happen, the child should know the meanings, like the vocabulary of the Holy Quran. Otherwise, it will be definitely difficult for the child to understand. So I would say, like, to begin with the shortest surahs and the famous surahs, which are normally used in our day-to-day lives, like Surah Al-Fatiha, Surah Al-Ikhlas, Surah Al-Kawthar, Surah Al-Qadr, and Falaq and Nas, and the shorter ones, you can see at the end of the Holy Quran. So if you teach them the meanings, and of course there's another sequence as well, which they normally go through. Rather than that, if you kind of focus on the surahs, the meanings of the surahs, I think it's much better. Why? Because when you ask the child after they are done with the vocabulary, you ask them, okay, can you tell me the meaning of this verse? They will be able to tell you without looking at the Holy Quran.
Yes.
If you ask a certain word, example, what is the meaning of Alhamd? What is the meaning of Iyaka?
Yeah.
When they say and when they understand the meaning and when they recite it with meaning and understanding, they'll feel a sense of accomplishment.
Right.
Rather than going through a proper sequence, which normally the elders do, when they go through the whole book and then they go through the verses.
You're reminding me of one of the shoppings that I did lately, but I'll tell that about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold. thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is with us, helping parents guide how to help your children learning Quran beyond memorization. Well, you said work with the words like what is Alhamd, and also like I was going through one of the markets here in Iran, in Qom itself. So it's very famous for the Quran books. And I was looking for something interesting, I don't know, with regards to my son. And I found one of the Qurans, alhamdulillah, they have worked upon, was words had, there was a Quran where each word had a meaning beneath it, and every word was with different colors, in different print. It was a bit expensive, though, but I think it was very worth. Because when I got it, I kept it at home and I showed to my son, and he was like, I will learn 5 words every day. And then whoever the guest comes, I don't know why they get attracted to it and they open it and see it. And my also like one of my relatives was like, this is one of the worst spendings you have done. Like you get a lot of toys and other things, but this is something very much worth of. Yep. So yeah, this really helped. Mm. Learn those words separately.
Yeah, perfect. Indeed, it's very important as well. Like, of course, rather than just the words are there, of course, but other than the words, tafsir, a bit of tafsir is also very important. So, example, if you are able to teach your son or your daughter, your child, tafsir of the Holy Quran, or there are books like tafsir, which is just one volume. Which talks about the tafsir and gives the explanation of that one page, basically. Yeah. So, in good words, like basically in one flow, I would say, mm-hmm. and connecting all the dots of the Holy Quran, or like on that page itself, even that is helpful for kids of, I would say, like younger age, yeah, like 8, 10, and stuff like that. So, this is number 2. With this, they will get more understanding of the Holy Quran, okay. more understanding of the surahs. And the third thing is once they are done with this, they are done with the words, they are done with the tafsir part as well, like the smaller tafsir part, then you can start a discussion with them and you can ask them about the reflections of what they have thought about the verses of the Holy Quran. So, example, if you ask them, Iyaka na'budu wa iyaka nasta'een. Okay, my dear son or daughter, like, what do you think about it? That you have learned, mm-hmm. what do you think? What is your extraction? Why? Because children normally have a sense of imagination, mm-hmm. okay? So when you give them a content, and if you tell them, okay, convert it into an imaginative piece, they would do it very beautifully. Like, would convert it into some imaginary structure which normally doesn't come into our minds, yeah?
Indeed.
So maybe they create something out of it and you want to hear it, for sure. And maybe, like, of course, there are adjustments sometimes, like, maybe you want to correct it, or maybe you can say, wow, that's something strange and something amazing. Like, even it's a piece of advice for me as well, yeah? So if you engage your children like in discussions about the verses, they are reciting, and ask them questions and ask them like, how can you apply this verse in your life? I think that will even more progress their connection with the Holy Quran, what they have learned.
Indeed. And so definitely we have some more steps, but we would come to the concluding section of today's program after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have 3 features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are talking about how do parents guide their children about Quran deeper than the memorization. Well, brother, you said like first we should go ahead with the vocabulary of Quran and try to make them understand the Quranic vocabs, like the small words of Arabic, and then you also said it's not a difficult task to go for tafsir. Try to connect the points, and when you realize that, for example, they have understood a particular verse, try to ask them more reflections about that verse. Mm-hmm. Maybe they come up with some new points that are more creative in nature. So yeah.
Yep. So there's another thing is when they are unable to do this, then you relate it with lifetime examples, you see. So example, like if you ask them a verse, what about Iyyaka na'budu wa Iyyaka nasta'in, and how can you relate it to your life, and they are like clueless about it, okay, then you can tell them, okay, Iyyaka na'budu wa Iyyaka nasta'in, what's the meaning of Iyyaka na'budu? Okay, they will say, okay, to you only we do worship, and from you only we seek help. So you will be like, okay, so you're worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and you're also seeking help in every single part of your life. Okay, in your homework, did you seek help from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? In the tournament which you were playing, the football tournament, did you seek help from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? You see, like in every single part of their life, you are able to like connect the verse to them. Ihdina sirat al-mustaqim, likewise, and the later on verses, of course.
Parents say this or have this concern, maybe tafsir is something heavy in the very early age. So what age do you suggest for going ahead with tafsir?
Okay, this is a beautiful question, I would say, because from one child to another, the
intellectual level.
Yeah, the intellectual level and the grasping power matters.
Okay.
Okay, so it's upon the parent to decide. Now, is it the time that my child can go through this tafsir course as well? Maybe like there's a child who can start at the age of like 6 or even 7, like this example. All right. And there might be a child who might have to start at 8 or even 9.
Yeah.
Okay? Because of the grasping power, and of course we don't blame anyone. Okay, yeah. Why is this child learning late? They are children like who differ with regards to intellect, with regards to grasping power. So we can't give a proper age just like that. Okay, this is the age for learning words, vocabulary of the Holy Quran. This is the age of tafsir example. So, but from beginning onwards, if we keep them in this flow, okay, today you have 2 words to learn. For tomorrow you have like 3 words to learn. And you keep on asking them like on a daily basis, okay, what is this? What is this word? What does it mean? Okay, now make it together, club them, join them together. It will not take a lot of time. It will not take even 5 minutes of your day.
Yeah.
It'll take you like 2 or 3 minutes maybe. So with this, and even you can do this when you're having your dinner, example, when you're working, when you're playing, example, and in this manner, inshallah, I would say the reflection of the Quran will be seen more in our day-to-day lives, inshallah.
Indeed, because we are told quite a number of times in Quran, أَفَلَا يَتَفَكَّرُونَ, why don't you ponder in the Quran? So, which makes it clear. And also the tone Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses here, that we have to reflect in the holy verses of Quran. Thank you so much, brother, for helping us with those valuable insights. Thank you, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Long ago, Iranians used to wake up to the melodic sound of one of the iconic masters of classical Persian music, Hasan Kasai's song, Salam or Greetings. The renowned ney player who found the hidden potentials of the traditional Persian ney. In a way, you can say that all the reed flute players in Iran, directly or indirectly, are his pupils. Since ancient times, the ney or reed flute has been favored for producing rhythmic sounds. Made from a plant that can be found all across the world, the ney or reed. By studying the illustrations on the walls of the tombs in Egypt and ancient Greece, and according to the findings in Peru, this end-blown musical instrument can be dated back to at least 3,000 years ago. Considered as the forefather of the modern flute, the ney has always been known for its rich and sad sound. Neys can have different sounds depending on the location of the reed bed and the weather of the region in which the reeds grow, which in turn determine the length and thickness of the reed stems. In Iran, we have many musical instruments with different structures that are made using reeds. All of these wind-blown instruments have experienced many changes over the years, both in structure and finger placement. The most important reed flute in Iran is Neyehaft Band, or the seven-segment ney. Because of the depth of its sound, the ney has always been favored by Sufis and mystic artists, and has been depicted in many illustrations, such as the wall paintings at the famous 40-column pavilion in Isfahan. In Persian poetry, renowned poets such as Rumi and Hafiz have mentioned the ney countless times in their poems. A typical Persian ney has seven segments, six knots and six holes, one of which is on the back. The pitch of the ney varies depending on the finger arrangement. A highly skilled flute player can reach more than three octaves, but it's common to have several additional reed flutes to cover different pitch ranges or for playing technically difficult passages. The upper edge of the ney is placed inside the mouth between the two upper front teeth. By making use of a new finger placement chart, which was created by Master Hasan Nahid, playing the reed flute became much easier. Master Nahid has spent the better part of his life More than 50 years training young and enthusiastic pupils in the art of the Ney, and has produced many outstanding players, players such as Mohsen Roustan. There are many ways to play the Ney. For example, in one technique, a small stream of air is directed with the tongue over the entrance of the Ney, while the upper lip surrounds the upper part of the Ney. By moving the lip and tongue, you can change the pitch and the tone. Like learning a new language, you have to know how to hold the Ney, or the correct forms of finger placements. You also have to train your diaphragm so that you don't run out of breath. After all, the Ney is a wind instrument. And now we continue. Even though both timbre and loudness have an infinite variety, in a sense, the Ney didn't used to have a part in orchestras because of the restrictions of its range. All that changed in 1950 when Master Kasai fully revolutionized playing the Ney and gave it a prominent role. The instruments that complement the sound of the Ney in duet and group performances are string, percussion, and classical instruments. Make a really good Ney out of just any reed. The best ones used to make this musical instrument come from the reed beds found in the dry and desert regions around the cities of Kashan, Qom, and Isfahan. Once they're cut, they're left to dry for 2 whole years in a shadowed area. Then they're sun-dried for 1 whole summer. That is when they can be worked. Making a Ney also requires a lot of hands-on experience, from heating its uneven notes to coating it with a mixture made from toasted ground hulled sesame seeds, to making the holes, bandaging its knots with deerskin and wood glue, and finally decorating the piece. A Ney maker needs to know all the techniques and timings. Like we said, the Ney has been mentioned extensively in the old poetry of Iran. So it's not surprising that here it is that very same poetry that's been burnt onto this piece of reed and has been used to decorate this beautiful Ney. How can we talk about the Persian Ney without naming Naib Asadullah, the first master in Iran who was well-versed in playing the Persian Ney? According to Master Asadullah, I was the one who took the reed flute from the sheep's pen to the king's court. When God created man, he blew a part of his spirit into the clay, the breath of life. Our spirit longs to be reunited with its origin, longs to be whole again. Perhaps in his most famous poem, Rumi says that the sound of the Ney calling out to the reed bed is reminiscent of that longing. This is Gulnar Farnoodi for Iran.
Allah 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 Allah
Ya Rabbi
Allah Allah
Ya Rabbi
Allah Allah Allah
Allah.
There's a light that still shines from the faces of those near. In the night they will stand and cry in hope and in fear. Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say,
afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We'll start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have The Bridge. The program offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the noble book, Sahifa Sajadia. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for this hour.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The European E3, as they were called, France, the UK, and Germany, initiated the snapback mechanism last month to reimpose nuclear-related sanctions on Iran. This provision was part of the 2015 UN Security Council Resolution 2231, which culminated in the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, a plan of action where Iran was to give unprecedented access to its peaceful nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Iran did its part. The rest of the parties involved, though, failed to do theirs, starting with the U.S., who abandoned the deal altogether in May of 2018. Yet the Europeans have put the blame on and are seeking retribution against Tehran for non-compliance, just as Iran has entered into a new cooperation framework with the International Atomic Energy Agency, a fresh arrangement that Iran says it will immediately abandon should the Europeans insist on this unjust and coercive strategy or gamble. And this is a topic of our Spotlight program. But first, for our guests. Joining us is John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Fredericton, Canada. And Reza Vedadi, academic researcher and author, joining us from London. Gentlemen, pleasure to have you both on. Reza, we're going to start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well there, pal, in the UK. So what do we make of the JCPOA signatories, the E3? Iran says they failed to do enough toward the deal's preservation and function initially to even be able to speak of non-compliance and reimposition of sanctions. Your initial thoughts on this?
As you know, we've discussed this issue several times together on this show. And it's something that the Europeans are utilizing to try and align themselves possibly with the hawkish side of the United States foreign policy and to try and appease the Israelis. As we know that, you know, there's a genocide taking on Israel, and the Europeans have done everything to assist in this genocide. They haven't done anything to prevent it. So now they are using the last kind of card that they have, the last card up their sleeve, to try and appease that side of this conflict between the Iranians and the Western side. So I don't believe that they're going to get much out of it. The sanctions that will be reimposed are not economic sanctions. There's no way they can implement these sanctions. They weren't able to implement them 10 years ago. Now that Iran is much more powerful country with its powerful navy, the navy has increased, developed a lot in the last 10, 15 years. It's very difficult for them to try and impose any of these sanctions. The only thing they're trying to use this is to impact Iranian economic psychology, to try and put pressure on the Iranian economic scene to, you know, increase the rate between the toman, the rial, and the dollar, and cause that kind of hardship to the people. But other than that, there isn't much more of this sanction. If it's implemented, if the Russians and Chinese don't prevent it from being implemented, can do to Iranian country.
And when we say the last card, Riza, that the Europeans are playing, it's funny that they don't take a step back and see how it's worked out for the U.S. When the U.S. has been on a full-blown bully mode, coming when it comes to Tehran, ratcheted up full sanctions and pressure to try to get Iran to come screaming or crying to the negotiation table on its knees, it always basically got the opposite. And the Europeans, when they showed a little bit more autonomy and diplomacy, they seem to have gotten farther with Tehran in the past. Why they would choose to ditch that for trying to ramp up pressure on Tehran, thinking that they'll be more conducive to some kind of positive outcome, it boggles the mind in some respects.
I mean, you're right. Absolutely. Logically, when you think about it, it doesn't make sense. But I think if we look at it in the context that are they doing it to appease someone else, to try and show favor with another person, then it makes sense. Other than that, it's literally the last card they have. And Iranians have stated to them that if you use this mechanism against Iran, from now on, you will not even be discussed. You will not be in the room. You will not be part of any negotiations that take place between Iran and possibly the United States. So they've kind of sidelined themselves. And I think they knew that they were going towards that direction. They were like a third wheel, that they weren't assisting in anything during the sanctions, when during the JCPOA, when United States left and imposed the maximum pressure during Trump's 2018 first regime. Initially they were discussing about having a mechanism that will provide Iran with economic relief, but that never took place. So they've always been a soft, good cop to the America's bad cop. But their agenda and their aim has always been the same as the United States.
And the Iranian leadership has said this, and they call this narrative and trajectory unfortunate and proof, to your point, the Europeans are compromised by the U.S., have abandoned diplomacy, and that this gamble will not pay off if they will achieve through pressure what they failed through diplomacy and illegal attacks against the country. Do you think they are optimistic, the Europeans, that they'll achieve something this time around with this pressure tactic against Tehran? And if so, what do you think that objective or that outcome from their perspective may be?
No, I think they knew that Iran would not accept the restrictions. The three conditions they put was to have access to the sites that were bombed, access to Iran's enrichment and restriction on enrichment and all other facilities. Basically, they want to find out what damage the attack, the 12-day attack, achieved, and what other attacks need to be conducted. So it's more of a espionage information gathering tactic, and I'm pretty sure they knew that Iranians would never accept these conditions. So I think they thought, okay, if their snapback is going to expire, I think in about a month's time or less, let's at least use that. So then, you know, we believe the sanctions will come back, and then we can utilize those leverages in a different way on Iran, which we'll see how it will work out.
And let's lay out the timeline for this for our viewers to see the absurdity into it, Reza. Maybe you could help us out with this. So last month, France, Germany, and the UK, they triggered the snapback mechanism. Why? Because they say that Iran refused to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency in allowing their inspectors to visit bombed nuclear sites by the U.S., which is ironic because Iran firmly believes that it was compromised intelligence that was given to the adversaries of the country by the IAEA that resulted and it's beyond nefarious and ridiculous to allow the IAEA immediate inspection at those sites. And then, but still, even with 2 weeks after that, Iran started speaking to the IAEA to try to reengage diplomatically and come up with a new framework, considering of obviously that the attacks are going to result in a new framework of understanding between the two.
I mean, the fact that they also did not condemn something that is in international law classified as an illegal, extremely illegal act, whereby attacking a nuclear facility, a peaceful nuclear facility by another state, by another country, by another military, is against all international protocols or international laws or international norms of conduct. And we saw how they made a big deal when, I think a year or so ago, they were saying that the Russians are attacking a nuclear power plant that was in the territory of the Ukrainians during this conflict that they have. And they were up in arms about that, and yet the UN Security Council, the UN, and the IAEA did not condemn United States and Israel for what it has done. So even if we say that they did not conduct espionage, which we know they have, there's Iranians have the proof of that, and it's evident everywhere. And also the fact that when there was negotiations between the IAEA during the Trump negotiation period, the IAEA head, Grossi, would visit Israel and then visit Iran, or visit Iran and then visit Israel. Why is this person visiting Israel? For what reason is the head of the IAEA has any reason to visit Israel other than it's reporting to Israel? So there's many, many reasons why Iran should not be dealing with the IAEA on a fair footing.
Thank you. And joining us also, Mr. John Bosnich from Fredericton, Canada. John, good to have you. Thanks for your patience there, pal. Now, the IAEA, John, seems content on building on this new arrangement to sit with Tehran and carve out a new understanding, an understanding that has to take into account the U.S.-Israeli aggression, obviously, a fact that took place as talks were underway diplomatically, the fact that the IAEA shared info about Iran. I was just sharing with Reza, I don't know if you heard us, whether deliberately or unknowingly, with those who attacked the country. Can the Europeans realistically, John, expect this not to impact Iran's cooperation with the IAEA and even with them moving forward?
Well, if the Europeans were what we could call adult, mature nations, no, they couldn't accept these conditions, but they are not. We have to remember that the European nations are basically military colonies of the United States and of the broader Anglo-American empire. And so these colonies are called upon to vote in favor of things that are given to them for rubber stamping by the United States. They are not called upon to take a position against the United States or against their trainers in England who bring them there with their Rhodes scholarships to teach them how to run an empire. This is a complete facade. These organizations, the UN, the Security Council, when it's not under proper control, the IAEA, all of these organizations are velvet gloves pulled over the mailed fist of the American empire to make it look like there's an international consensus that they represent. They do not represent any kind of an international consensus. They are pillaging and raping this planet, and they are bombing, pulverizing any states that stand up for their national sovereignty.
Thank you there, John. And Reza, can you please weigh in on this? Can the Europeans expect this year's chain of events against Iran not to impact Tehran's future cooperation with the IAEA, which is today in a preliminary stage of a new form of establishment, and that Iran is guaranteed will end immediately should there be a reimposition of sanctions? And does that even matter for them, that this little bit of hope and glimmer of cooperation with the IAEA and Tehran will be null and void should the snapback go through?
We have to bear in mind that the pressure that Iran was under 10 years ago when it accepted to sign the JCPOA and have those extreme restrictions put on it by IAEA and the UN.